That's the answer. Tom. So what does Rav Arush say in this book? Rav Arush says, he brings a story of a very difficult situation. Very difficult situation. Where I can't remember the exact details, that someone dies, it's a husband, it's a child, it's whatever it is. And she's left in a very awkward position without parnasa, with children to look after, the chulin, etc., etc. So, what happens in that story? In that story, she goes to the Rav, who is a big gadol, and he tells her that actually it's based on a Gilgul, the reason why your husband, your child, I can't remember, your husband, I think, had to die. It was a whole big inyan. And she was comforted afterwards. She was happy, she could, but up until then she wasn't happy. So it can be circumstances where, if a person's not holding on, that knowing about past lives can help. But if a person is holding on, then we don't need to, we don't necessarily need to know. But it's good to know these things exist. It's good to know that there is such a thing, and I have been here before. Because it can be comforting, can be helpful. Also, it's just good to know, because it's part of Torah, it's part of Hashem. Okay, Yofi. So there was a woman, Rav Yaakov is telling me, he's writing to me. I'm getting mail. Here we go. Right? Who had a fear of using the mikvah because she had fear of water.
Wow.
She could accept a shower, but she couldn't accept a bath or a mikvah.
Wow.
She just couldn't go in it. She was too fearful. So what happened? She went to a mikvah. But I'm told the reason why you're fearful is because you drowned in a previous lifetime. You drowned. So the chora, it's obvious that you're fearful of, right? No, there's no psak. The point is that helped her get over it. Because with that knowledge, she doesn't need to worry. It's something that's, Tom, I understand why, and you can work through it. But otherwise, you don't know that. You see water, you're like, get me away from it. So, therefore, it's a very nice, helpful reason. Good example of where this stuff is useful. Can be useful. Yeah. Okay, Yafi. We are in our list of people who used to be other people. Who's next? Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu. Who is Moshe? Tov. Moshe is in every generation. Moshe is Moshiach. Moshe da Moshiach. We're told in the Zohar. Right? There's a spark of Moshe, a spark of Moshiach in every generation. There's possibly also a spark of Moshiach in every single person. Anyway, but in terms of Moshe being leader of Am Yisrael, who was he previously? So we have information here that Moshe, the spark of Moshe, was present in Noah. There was a lot of similarities between Noah and Moshe, right? For a start, for example, Noah was saved from the flood by going into the ark. Moshe Rabbeinu was saved from the river by going into the ark. Same word, teva. They were both saved from water by being in the ark, in an ark. A teva, the little thing that Moshe was in, the little basket, it's called a teva. Same as the ark that Noah was in, was also called a teva. Water is also a key part of Moshe. The name Moshe means to be drawn out, to drawn out from the water. That's where he got his name from.
But when I look at the similarities, it's what you're looking for, tikkun.
Yes, but they both help, because the similarity is usually is part of the tikkun. So you can look here and see why was the teva of Moshe a tikkun for the teva of the ark? So I don't know. It doesn't say here, but you
maybe different.
No, because Noah was blamed for the flood because he didn't
he wasn't forceful enough to have people do tshuva. He was more concerned about, you know, okay, I'm building up an ark when they ask. But it's not like he's going out and saying, you got to do tshuva or else you're going to get the flood.
Right. Okay. So that was the major tikkun. The major tikkun that he had to do was that Noah, we know, we said Noah was righteous in his generation. And the Perush is he was righteous in his generation. But would he been in the generation of Moshe or of Abraham, he wouldn't have been righteous in another generation. Why not? So he was a tzaddik, but he didn't pray for people to save the people. Right? He built an ark, took him 120 years. Mm-hmm. And he didn't pray all that time. However, when he comes back at Moshe, we see that Moshe prays for Israel the whole time. And to the extent where Moshe says, erase me from your book, if you're not going to accept them and forgive them, erase me from your book, which is a tikkun for him not having prayed for them and letting them all die.
But Moshe was
saving himself.
Moshe was more successful. At least he was able to get 20% of the Jews out.
Moshe was only more successful because he tried.
Right.
We know.
He was more successful because he tried. At least he was able to get 20% out.
Okay. So yeah, so that's another similarity is that Moshe lived to the age of 120. That's the period of his life that he needed to correct during that 120 years. He needed to have done what Moshe did during that 120 years to save people. Well, we don't know if he prayed for himself, but he didn't pray for Am Yisrael. I don't know who he did pray for. We don't see who he did pray for. He did pray for the people. There was no, even Moshe, there was no Am Yisrael.
He saved his family.
He only saved his family because Hashem told him to take them into the ark with him. Hashem said, take them into the ark.
Otherwise, he would have gone alone.
Don't know. I'm not saying, I can't say, but we don't know. He prayed for those people who were about to be destroyed, which was Am Yisrael. Whereas people who were about to be destroyed in the case of Noah was everyone. Okay. You also see the 40 days and 40 nights is also another connection between Noah, the story of Noah and right? Lots of 40 days and 40 nights going on there. How exactly one to tick up the other. So, anyway, praying 40 days and 40 nights during the time that all the destruction is happening. The rain is the destruction. It's 40
days. During the 40 days and 40 nights, was rain, was eating?
He was what?
No, he was eating. They brought food for everyone.
They were having a ball. He had to feed everyone, right? The lion bit his foot. You know that story? The lion that bit his foot. The Midrash says the lion bites Noah in the foot because he didn't bring him his food in time. Running around. Something.
I think he didn't bite it, he kicked it.
Kicked
it. Right.
The cat scratched him.
Cat scratches are extremely painful.
Cat scratch.
As I can tell you personally.
You need to feed him on time. Okay, Yofi, learn from Noah. Okay. Okay, what's next? So also, a spark of Moshe came from Hevel, from Cain and Hevel, right? And when he fled Egypt, he had to kill the Egyptian, right? He didn't have to, but he did kill the Egyptian. The Egyptian had a spark of Cain, and that was a measure for measure, meter, connected meter. The Egyptian top contained a spark of Cain, and Moshe had the spark of Hevel, and he had to kill the Egyptian. He was rectifying the murder of Hevel by Cain. Okay. Next, Yitro. Yitro had part of the neshama of Cain too, but his more rectified side, whatever that means. And he made a tikkun for Cain by when Cain said, am I my brother's keeper? Right? He kills his brother. Cain kills Heather. Gets jealous. Kills him. Shem comes to Cain and say, "No, where's your brother?" And Cain turns to Hashem and says, "What? I'm meant to be my brother's keeper? I'm meant to know the answer where he is?" And Hashem says, "His blood is screaming to me from the ground." Right? So Cain here is demonstrating that he is rebelling or rejecting a system of divine justice. Right? What's it to do with me? Right? I'm allowed to kill him. Rejecting the idea that I should have to pay for that. So that's rectified through Yitro, because what it says here. So Yitro, because Yitro advised Moshe regarding setting up an orderly system of judgment, judges, which is a rectification of the fact that he rejected dinim and laws of judgment, and now he's helping fix up that there should be judges, there should be judgment. Okay. Part of Cain also is reincarnated into Korach. Korach. Why? Because when Korach is killed, the earth opens up and swallows him. And this is Mida Kekeneged Mida for the blood of Hevel, which is also described as in the same terms, in similar terms, in the Pasukim of being the blood of Hevel being swallowed into the ground. So, now, what does it say next? Another figure who is identified as having a spark of Moshe is Rashbi HaKadosh, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay. Just like Moshe transmitted the Torah to Am Yisrael, so too Rabbi Shimon, he also transmits new Torah, new light to Am Yisrael. Arizal, as we know, also comes next in that trilogy. He doesn't bring Rav Nachman. He goes the three of them. There's Moshe, Rabbi Shimon, and then the Arizal. He brings here the Arizal. What do you say? The connection is here. He says about the Arizal, even when he lived in Egypt, he brought his family to the kever of Rav Shimon for the haircut of his three-year-old son. And later, he settled in...
Shishlam Amarosh.
12 o'clock. 12 o'clock, Shir of Babarosh. Another half an hour. Okay, when he was in Sfat, he would be a frequent visitor to the kever. There were a lot of people, particularly on Lag BaOmer. One time when they were gathered at the site, the Arizal and his students, the Arizal described how Rabbi Shimon's inner circle would sit with him when they were studying together. He showed them the exact spot where Rabbi Shimon and his son Rav Elazar would sit, and where each of the students named in the Zohar had their places. He then revealed to his students how they were all the soul sparks of those earlier students of Rav Shimon, each of the students of the Arizal. He then sat in the place of Rav Shimon and put Rabbi Chaim Vital in Rav Elazar's place, and then put each of his students in the place of the particular Rav that he was the spark of. And then when they were all seated, he began to expound on the Zohar, and he revealed that Rabbi Shimon and his students and many other great sages were there present with them to hear their words of Torah.
Oh.
Those were the dates. So, Yofi, we know from our teachers that that spark was then passed into the Baal Shem Tov and then into Rabbi Nachman. Why? Because they were the other two major figures involved in revealing new light, new Torah into the world. Right? And the written Torah, the oral Torah from Moshe. We then have the Zohar from Rabbi Shimon. We have the Kabbalah from the Arizal. The Besh, Baal Shem Tov, brought us the light of Chassidut. And Rav Nachman brings us the light of Geula. What does it mean, the light of Geula? It's the light of how to be a Jew in the time of Moshiach, right? In the time of when there's Emunah, when the time when everyone understands what it means, what who Hashem is, what it means to know Hashem, what we have to do. Which is a different light that's applicable for that time. It's not applicable. Wasn't applicable in the previous generations to know that. Right? We're still working on the inner aspect, the outer aspect, I guess. This is working inner, to the inner core of Torah. Okay.
So if we see Jews arguing and having a disagreement of some kind, are we supposed to step in the middle of that and say, you know, we're supposed to love each other as brothers, that's not the way to behave? Or are we supposed to just walk on by?
Why would you say that? I mean, it would seem the answer to your question seems obvious, so it can't be an obvious answer you're looking for. Because the obvious answer is no, you go and help. You don't just watch.
If two or more Jews are having a disagreement on something, should you enter that disagreement?
Okay, so it depends. So there's a practical and a theoretical. The theoretical is I should love every Jew and I should want no Jew to fight, and it should, if I see two Jews fighting, it should kill me, right? It should pain me.
Right.
Practically speaking, should I actually get involved in this particular argument? Probably not. I mean, it depends on what's going on. Rav Sperling, one of my previous rabbis in Machon Meir, told a story that once in his building. You'll note that in Israel, in the apartment buildings, that there's an idea that people basically they try and occasionally, not everyone, but some people try and take a little bit more land, a little bit more space, right? So they kind of move their mirpeset, their balcony out a little bit. They'll build into the garden. Everyone tries to expand a little bit. So anyway, so in his building, he saw that one of the upstairs neighbors was deciding to move it a little bit into the lobby, right? And I've seen houses when I was looking for houses, particularly in one place, very common, right? And we went to see an apartment, and whilst all the other apartments had a little corridor leading to them, this apartment didn't. This apartment, the front door was mamash at the, just as you, right? So we just took that extra bit. Basically, took the corridor outside, bricked it up, and made it part of his apartment. Anyway, so Russ Berling was saying that what was happening. So upstairs, the guy in one of the upper floors, he started putting plant pots of plants out in the lobby, around near his door, to start screening off a little section. And it's a well-known derech that this is leading up to taking that bit for me, right? So one of the other neighbors saw this, and was not having any of it. That's my lobby too. I'm not letting you take my lobby. So he started smashing the guy's plant pots. He told him to move them already, and he refused to move. No, they're my plant pots. I'll put them where I want it. It seems that this was like already in. Started smashing plant pots. So anyway, while Sperling comes home, he hears this smashing, and he hears this screaming, and he goes to and he sees that they're having a big fight, and this guy's smashing plant pots. And he doesn't know what to do. Should I go in and try and, you know, two Jews fighting? The two hush of a Jews is in a big from apartment block, where Ralph Sperling is. Right? He's not really sure what to do, and he's a big man by himself, but he thinks, you know what? Let me go and ask someone greater than me, very sensible. So he goes down to one of his other neighbours, who's an older Talmid Chacham, and he says, knocks on the door, says, oh, sorry to disturb you, but you know upstairs this is happening, and he explains what's happening. He says, should I go and try and break them up? The same question. Should I go and get involved? And Talmid Chacham, the older Jew, says, no. He says, he's smashing pan pots. Better it's plant pots than your face. Right? So that's also Torah. That's also good advice, that you need to sometimes go to a chacham to tell you, no, don't get it. Even though, obviously the correct thing is we don't want any fights. We know, but the person has to know, is this going to help or not? But, obviously we don't know. We don't know for sure what's going to be. If I step in, am I going to... But a person has to use his best judgment as to... from the information that Hashem has given me, the understanding, the experiences of my life, what's going to happen now if I try and do X?
If you ever have a problem, I have something that's a very good persuasion that you can borrow it.
Okay, and so that's your other alternative. Take Menachem's number after the class. Call Menachem, and then you don't have to worry. You've fulfilled your obligation. You put it all onto Menachem. Okay.
Or you take my number, and we can give you five cats. They'll. Yes. It will not be any problem.
Tom, okay. Now, back to where we were.
One thing is also, if I'm not mistaken, one of the terms of a Muslim mentions that if you are not professional in getting involved with this thing,
you okay, so he says that Rav Natan also mentions, perhaps, in one of the... He says, don't get involved in a dispute unless you know it.
Says you shouldn't try to correct the rasha unless you're a tzaddik mushlam.
Yeah, that's right.
Or if you're connected to, or if you're connected. He said rasha is like a storm wind. He said a storm wind in its time is very powerful and it can destroy you. Even though it's a negative influence, because in its time, but it will blow itself out. So when it's raging as a storm wind, you don't want to get involved, right? Because it's very dangerous, right? Either physically or spiritually speaking. And therefore, only someone who's completely clean. Why? Because the Yetzer Hara, the negative force that is within that person, attaches to my negative forces, right? So unless I'm pure, I'm going to get dragged in. Right, and we see that, right? We see that if someone gets dragged into an argument, the next thing you know, they're shouting too, right? And it's all gone crazy. How did I get involved in that? Suddenly I'm shouting and I'm getting, right? Because even though I was coming at it initially from a good point to try and calm it down, my Yetzer Hara got stirred up and I was away. Before I knew it, I was also gone because I've got a Yetzer Hara and that was got caught up in that Yetzer Hara that was on the other side of the argument. But if I don't have a Yetzer Hara like the Tzaddik, then fine, I can get involved in anything and it's not going to bother me. It's going to be like, well, doesn't matter, you shout at me all you like, it doesn't bother me. I'm not going to get. But if I've got a Yetzer Hara, meaning I've got an ego, I've got whatever it is, I've got arrogance, you can't shout at me, then I've lost it. But if I'm sufficiently connected to the Tzaddik, what does that mean? To be connected to the Tzaddik means I'm putting myself aside. You're right, I've got all these issues, I've still got terrible problems, I've still got terrible midot. And it's very dangerous for me to get involved as me. If I put myself, Reuven Levy, into this situation, we're finished. Right? I'm going to be smacking him too. Right? But if I'm sufficiently connected to the Tzaddik, then that means to be connected means that I'm not me. I'm kind of walking in with as the Tzaddik, as him. Like, I'm just the pipe. Right? This is not appropriate. You shouldn't be doing it. Why? Well, I don't know. My teachers tell me. nothing to do with me, because I think it's, it, as long as it ends fire, I think it's what you're doing is not appropriate, and I can tell you why. That that's me, and I've lost it. But if I'm coming in as a shaliach, if you like, then potentially it doesn't affect me. It's not me. Okay.
Anyway, I'll just tell you the story. It's kind of cute.
Oh, okay.
The bus, I live in Efrat, so the bus gets to Efrat, and it starts going through the Zayit, which is a suburb of Efrat, and two Breslovers loaded with books got on the bus, and they did not have the exact bus fare.
Okay.
Which is like normal. Nobody
right.
does. So, but they only had big bills, and the
okay.
driver did not want to make change.
Okay.
It's like two or three shekels to ride around in Efrat.
Right.
And he wanted them either to get the money or get off the bus.
Right.
So, one of the guys got on the telephone, and I guess he called his Rebbe or something, smiling the whole time, trying to make light of it, reasonably upset.
Right.
Let's figure out how we can handle this. And the guy on the other end told him to get off the bus.
Yeah.
Don't to cause any machlokes. There's other people on the bus. And
yeah, fair.
Just get off the bus.
Okay.
And because it's only a bus. There's other ways to get around. Of course, not in the fraud. Not in the bus.
Okay.
You can't get
around. Go get change.
The, there's nowhere to get change either. And I don't remember the guy was going to come out and get them or send somebody. There aren't any Breslovers who live in Efrat, even though there are people who teach them. They teach throughout the Rebbe. So they, there are people who are knowledgeable about Breslovers.
Right.
But I have no idea who they were in contact with. It had to be like their Rebbe. But it was very interesting that the guy was, his, you know, was I can't even say was a Zionist. He was an older gentleman, no kippah. I'm just going to make an assumption that he wasn't a religious guy.
Right.
From the total lack of respect that he had for them. Normally, if it's a religious guy, they'll have respect for every other religious person.
Right.
This guy had no respect. And he was an older gentleman. And so rather than cause a big scene and, you know, whatever,
so they did a big Kiddush Hashem?
Yeah.
A big Kiddush Hashem.
See, and I was like, I didn't know what to do. I was like right behind the bus driver. I was like two seats behind. I had change. I didn't know, should I reach in my pocket and pay the bus fare? I could do that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I should do that or not.
Why not?
You know, I just didn't know what I should do in that particular instance.
Okay.
Because I'm not 100% sure of the language and the nuances of the discussion.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if that was the right thing or not.
Okay. So Rav Nachman teaches that any good intention is never lost. So even if you wanted to do the right thing and it didn't turn out right, you still did the right thing,
yeah.
Right? So and the fact that you had the intention that you wanted to pay, it's also good. So yeah, it's good. Okay.
So just be careful when you go sell books to the door.
Careful in the front. Okay. The author of the Tanya, Rabbi Shneur Zalman. The Adi. Right, we're in the wrong yeshiva. Now, he's a great rabbi. We hold by all the great rabbis. He explains that every Jew contains a spark of Mashiach, spark of Moshe. And that gives us the desire for Mashiach, the desire for the completion and the rectification of the world. That's within each of us. That's from our spark of Moshiach, because that's his Moshiach. That's all his. That's his entire being is to rectify the world. Right? He's on fire, will be on fire for just rectifying and changing the world and making it perfect and bringing us all back to Hashem. Right? And we all have a spark of that within us. He says that when enough people clarify and activate their own spark of Mashiach, there will be a critical mass of redemptive energy which will be set in motion, ultimately leading to the revelation of Mashiach into the world. Gan Emunah, something like that. Okay, next.
That's already happened.
It's on its way. Well, Mashiach hasn't arrived yet, but he's coming because of it. One of the... Hillel Hazaken, the great Hillel, was a reincarnation of, or certainly part of him was, spark of, Aaron HaKohen. Right? It was Hillel who said, Harei Bital Bital Shel Aaron. Right? Be part of Pirkei Avot. Be part of the students of Aaron. Love peace and pursue peace. Right? Hillel said that. Hillel Omer. We know that Hillel was the great peacemaker. Right? The man who came to him wanted to learn Torah on one foot. He was also another story in the Gemara where someone comes to him on Friday in Erev Shabbos and he's trying to take a shower and he keeps coming back. Keeps coming back several times, and every time he spends time with him, and he's even though he's a very difficult individual, keeps asking him weird questions that are not like inappropriate questions, like dumb questions. But he's, each time he comes back. So Hillel was very much into peace, and we see that's he had that same spot from Aaron. Elsewhere, Aaron's neshama also is reincarnated into Eli, the high priest. Eli the high priest of the Mishkan. Why? Because Aaron was never received any formal punishment in his lifetime for the Chetah Egel, for the golden calf. But we learned in Gemara that Aaron had reasons for allowing Am Yisrael to make the golden calf. He saw that Chor had died, had been killed, and he saw that Am Yisrael, that they would kill him. And he wasn't worried about his life particularly. But he was worried for Am Yisrael, what it would mean for Am Yisrael, that if they did that to Aaron, then Hashem wouldn't forgive them. Because Aaron was a priest, and this was maybe the fourth, and after the fourth you don't get forgiven. He brought a pasuk. That was in last week's Haftorah, actually. The beginning of last week's Haftorah was that pasuk. Anyway, so, but Aaron was never, we don't see in the Torah that he got any punishment for that. Right, for letting it happen. So what does it say here? So it says here, Eli also suffered from a similar problem. He showed a great weakness in his inability to discipline his son's actions. The Eli's sons were accused of molesting the women that came in. Uh-huh. Something like that. Rabbi Yaakov, you are Tanakh expert. Or Eli's sons, accused of. Of being with the women that came to the...
Yeah.
And taking money. Right? Yeah. Abusing their position of power.
What would they do?
Being with the women and taking money.
You mean having sex with them?
I don't know. I don't know if it says that in the book. Would say that? Having a relationship with them?
Improper behavior.
I don't think it's so explicit, but it's improper behavior. Look in the... Anyway, so, and Eli is rebuked for not... Eli is criticized for not having looked after his sons better. Rebuked them. Not rebuking them for it. What happens? At the end of 40 years as a high priest, the Palestinians, the Philistines, defeat Israel in a war and take the ark. When Eli hears about it, he falls backwards off his chair and breaks his neck. Shmuel Aleph, if you want to look at that. This was considered Mida Kenegan Mida for punishment. For the Shteiru Chot HaBrit, the two tablets being broken due to the sin of the golden calf. The two tablets being broken is symbolized by Eli's neck being broken, I guess. Don't know how. And that's what Aaron caused by allowing the golden calf to go ahead. So that was Tikkun in the form of Eli. Do a little bit more before the shear. Okay, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva and his second wife. Who was Rabbi Akiva's second wife? Rabbi Akiva's second wife was a Roman. Roman woman.
Yes.
Roman lady. Yeah. High society Roman matron. The wife of Turnus Rufus.
Uh-huh.
The wife of Turnus Rufus. That helps us. She was the wife of Turnus Rufus. Was a disputant of Rabbi Akiva, right? He, not like Rebbe and who did we say yesterday? Rebbe and Antonius. Right, Rebbe and Antonius, they were great friends, and Antonius was a good guy. But Turnus Rufus was one of those people that is always causing problems for Jews, right? And he was against Rabbi Akiva. Anyway, his wife, I can't remember the story now. We should check it out. The story comes about that the wife gets involved at one point and realizes the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. She's very beautiful. I've got bits of the story in my head, I haven't got the whole thing. And Rabbi Akiva's crying. You're going to write it for me. Why Rabbi Akiva's crying? She says, why are you crying and laughing? Why are you crying and why are you laughing? And he's crying and laughing because I'm about to get the answer, I think. Because he's laughing because he knows he's going to marry her. That's the laughing bit. But he's crying because, tough. It's a very nice Gemara over there. And at the end, he ends up marrying her. I don't know what you're in the middle of. I can't tell. Okay. But anyway, it's not in here, so I apologize for not having looked it up previously. I'm not so good on all the
times.
Tom, okay, so what are we learning here? Well, we'll come back to it when we can. But in the meantime, we're learning that Rabbi Akiva and his second wife, his first wife was Rachel, she was the kosher woman who put him back on their path. But after that, right, so Rabbi Akiva and his second wife were the rectification of two previous couples. Who? Shechem and Dinah, and Zimri and Cosby. Right? Because these were... No, because basically... I mean, the simple is... It's because it's a... Okay, so the common factor in each of those couples is that you have a Jew and a non-Jew.
Okay. That's it.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I don't have an explanation here of what
morality.
That was a tikkun. That's why it was a tikkun. He tikkuned it. They were both killed, right? Well, Dina not, but yeah.
So
Shechem was killed afterwards.
So
and Zimri and Cosby were killed afterwards.
So was Akiva.
And Rabbi Akiva was killed afterwards. Rabbi Akiva was killed for the sin of Yosef.
Yeah.
Who, Rabbi Akiva?
Yeah. No, he was
raped.
Raped, that's hot. That's like friend. Was he still married when he married the second one? Was his first wife still
married? I think so. Don't know.
Because he was separated from her for a long time.
24 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is afterwards. So this is after that period. This is after, because this is after he became famous and 24,000 students.
How's Akiva connected to Dina?
How does...
The same thing about Akiva and Dina? That was just something you said.
No. So there's another connection between the three couples. It's in the number 24,000. Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students. These were the 24,000 students. These were the 24,000 that died in the plague after Zimri and Cosby. And it's also taught that 24,000 was the number that were killed in Shechem. They were circumcised first, so they had Akiva had some spark of kedusha.
Whoa.
And then they were killed.
Shechem, I think it says there's only 600 men that were killed. 600 men and boys.
So here it cites a source.
It wasn't 24,000.
Cites a source here, the Emek HaMelech on Daf 40 Amud Bet says 24,000 men.
Discrepancy in that.
Okay.
Because they didn't have such a big city. They had two guys only killed 24,000.
Yeah.
I think there was 600.
No, no. I don't think there's 600. That could be wrong, but I don't remember 600.
I also know only two guys.
I don't think it says the number.
It wasn't just two guys, though.
There was only two guys.
I know. They were huge.
Two bar mitzvah boys.
You should learn from here that what happened to Yosef, right? But what happened in Shechem, right? You should learn that what happened with Yosef when he was taken by 4.5 Ishmaelim on a camel. He could have finished them off.
Obviously.
It wasn't any time, right? But he knew that it was Hashem's will. Right? It's not that.
Children of Yaakov.
We saw that Yaakov lifted the big stone with his little finger. They were huge.
Well, that's the advantage of martial arts. Our breed.
That's why in this parasha, when they celebrate Levi and Shimon, because they know the power of them.
And they only needed to circumcise them as a cover. That was the cover for doing it.
Really,
right? We saw Abraham went with Eliezer and destroyed the four kings against the five kings.
Never know, they could have used
the Midrash says it was either just Eliezer by itself or it was 315 people, which is the Gematria of Eliezer.
My solution was with like swords. It wasn't like they say that, you know, it's a privilege for a bow and arrow. Something double belt to kill 100, 500. This was not the bow and arrow, it was a sword.
Okay. Actually, through prayer, we see that after that, the Yaakov says that in the blessing of his sons, Yaakov says, on Shimon and Levi, one of them, he says that by my sword and my bow, ubachelbi, I defeated those that came after me. Right after what happened is that after they destroyed Shechem, so there was a backlash, and Yaakov got rid of them all. How? By bakashti ubachelbi. So that translates in the pshat as my sword and my bow. But Rashi translates over there, Rav Nachman brings it in Lukatei Moran, but it means prayer.
Prayer.
Right, Bakashti means Bakasha, request.
Prayer.
And Chaobi is Cherev Pipiot, the mouth there. Right, through the mouth. Right, so he prayed and they all died. So
we're not talking about 24,000 also. They also slaughtered all the animals.
Okay.
One thing left for women and two guys that escaped.
Oh, they take
but anything's possible, let us know who's behind you.
Take the children.
Oh, sorry, we should go by the way. It's time to wrap.